Hi, I'm Sydney.
And I'm Haley.
And this week's episode, The Future of Aquaculture,
is to dive for. Hi, Sydney.
Hello, how's it going?
It is going. I'm a little exhausted right now, but we are, you know, just doing our dang bestest out here. What about you?
Same over here. Just wrapping everything up before I leave on Monday to go to Western Australia to do my field work for 2 months. So, yeah. Gonna be living kind of remotely, March, April, May. So yeah, just trying to prep for that. But I should be able
That'll
to
be really
have
exciting.
Like lots of water time, which is exciting. So
yes, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm a little jealous. I must admit that I've not been getting very much dive time lately, which sucks. But just this weekend, I did get to start my tech diving class, which is really exciting.
Oh, yeah.
And was so much fun. I've been just thoroughly enjoying tech diving. And I feel like it builds a lot off of what we've already done as scientific divers. So like, luckily I've already had exposure to a lot of the skills and like the new equipment and things like that. So it was super fun.
That's awesome. I did have a dream last night about us diving.
Oh, that's so cute.
It wasn't it wasn't really a good one though.
Oh.
It was I'll make it quick, but basically you and Lawrence, Alec and I, some of my friends that don't even dive, and then also like some people from Florida from our past, and like everyone was going diving and like no one would tell me what time we were getting ready to get in the water. So we were like living on like a Caribbean island and everyone just kept like going diving or being ready to go diving without me. And then they'd all be like, well, we told you what time. And I was like, no, you didn't. So this whole dream was just me missing out on diving because people would tell me when we were going diving. And I was like, everyone's plotting against me. So
Sydney,
really
I will
dream.
Always tell you. I will always tell you what time I'm going diving. I promise.
And then in part of the dream, you and Lawrence were totally suited up. And it was just, I could just see your eyes and your mouth because you had your hoods on. And it was really funny.
Nice. Excellent. My goodness. Well, aside from our updates, do you have any marine science news for us?
I do. I know we've been talking a lot about the coral bleaching event in the Caribbean, and we've all been suspecting that it'll hit the Pacific, where I am now, and it looks like that is starting. So this was the first article that popped up today on Google when I was looking for ocean news, and coincidentally, it is also one of my study sites. It is a not well-known island off the eastern coast of Australia, kind of parallel to Sydney. And it's called Lord Howe Island, and the article says, Lord Howe Island faces major coral bleaching as ocean temperatures continue to break records. So there's fears that the coral bleaching that's started right now in southern Great Barrier Reef is starting to move south towards Lord Howe Island and the Norfolk Islands. And this is expected to be the worst heat stress event since 1985. So, yeah, this has been happening pretty recently. Like, I was just diving on the central Great Barrier Reef last week, and the bleaching isn't bad. You can tell some corals are stressed. They are starting to have those fluorescent colors, their natural sunscreen. Mm-hmm. But apparently the Great Barrier Marine Park Authority has just started carrying out some extensive aerial surveys, after confirming last week the extensive coral bleaching in the park's southern section. So it's beginning, and this is like really interesting and sad because the corals at Lord Howe and Norfolk Islands, it's estimated that 20 to 50% of them are not formally described. So we have lots of new coral species in these areas, these islands that are positioned in really unique areas. They're getting just the tail end of the Eastern Australia Current. So we've got some really interesting corals there. I'm also looking at some of the symbiont biogeography there. So lots of unique species, a unique ecosystem there. And yeah, they're expected to be impacted by this bleaching event.
Dang, that really sucks. And I don't know, just for all our Australia listeners and listeners who are traveling abroad this summer, well, your summer, your late summer are coming into spring, but just, I guess, keep your chin up. It's hard. Like, I watched it happen this last summer here in the Atlantic, and it was really hard to stomach, so, you know, just take care of yourself and do what you gotta do to keep your chin up, because I'm sure it'll get worse before it gets better.
Yeah. And luckily, it doesn't seem like it's hitting the rest of the GBR right now, but we'll see. And I'm interested to see the reefs in Western Australia, especially with spawning. Like, I don't know if they'll get hit the same. They kind of get cold water from this one current on Western Australia that comes down from Asia. So maybe they'll be okay, but
interesting.
We'll see. Yeah, it's a weird current. That's why we got some weird algal symbionts over there too.
Well, that is interesting, and I hope that it works out well. And yeah, I guess with that, we can get into our interview this week. Hopefully we'll all be a little bit cheerier after hearing more about how people are using land-based basins to help create a more sustainable interaction with our marine ecosystems. So with that, we can jump right into our interview and have our special guest introduce himself.
Hi, my name is Ethan Weber. I go by he, him, and I'm originally from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and currently living in Tallahassee, Florida. Very different place.
Yes.
Still Florida. It's crazy.
And before we get into what you do, will you tell us what drew you to the water originally?
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely the place I was fortunate to grow up in is on the water and nearby the Keys and a lot of incredible reefs and water. And really just that's kind of where I started spending my time and getting out there and kind of eventually ended up being really my escape from what the craziness of South Florida is. I'm sure Haley can attest now, like it's busy and there's really not a lot of nature or quiet areas, but the ocean is one out there, even though it's still pretty busy. But, you know, I was lucky to also grow up like on a canal and through my very young years and, you know, even still today when I go home, like grew up fishing on there. And that was kind of my first intro. And I was also very fortunate that, you know, my parents aren't necessarily like water people and my family, not really, but they're from the Midwest originally. But my neighbors, some of their parents, the dads were big fishermen, big boaters. And so we spent a lot of time when I was young getting out and the boat in South Florida, but then even going to the Keys and even the Bahamas, which that's really was my intro into like snorkeling and getting in the water and seeing the fish and a little bit of fishing. But that's kind of where I took off with it after on my own. And yeah, it's just something I really grew up in and loving and wanting to learn more about it. So that's, yeah, I think mostly place based, but I don't know. I think just fish in the water in general probably would have drawn me regardless of where I grew up. But I think, yeah, I have to lend it a lot to that and some of the things I was lucky enough to do. But it gave me a great perspective and also seeing it grow up and change and things die and all that, like, it's very cool. And yeah, it led to a no-brainer of like, okay, now school and studying that seems like the move, and I've never really looked back, honestly.
That's awesome. So you've always wanted to study something marine science, aquaculture related. Will you kind of tell us or like walk us through your background, like through schooling, education?
Yeah, like I said, I kind of knew pretty early on, probably like honestly middle school, I was like, okay, I think marine science would be really cool. So I, you know, a lot of people, interestingly, I talked about this with my boss today, like in our field, you hear all these stories of like how they ended up there, and it's like, it's just wild. It's all over the place. And I'm like almost an exception where I kind of knew this was the route and like somewhat how to get there. Now, with marine science being so broad, truly it still has branched and like gone all different ways, which has super been awesome. But yeah, I kind of knew early on, and looking for schools, I looked, you know, around a lot of places, and ultimately, partly financial reasons, but also I'm very happy with this decision, went to University of Florida for undergrad, which is a landlocked school. However, they have labs and other marine science related stuff on both coasts of Florida, which is pretty unique and very cool, and only about like a hour and a half drive. So we had some field trips out to those in some of my classes. And Florida's big into like fisheries research, but then found they have some aquaculture stuff and took one class with that. And, you know, growing up, I had saltwater aquariums, got into that with, you know, all my diving and loving fish, is like, that's, of course I'm going to do that and try and keep all these cool. And now fish like you're seeing out in the Great Barrier Reef, I can get ones way, in my opinion, cooler than the ones we have here, or at least at the time I thought that. That, you know, as I learned more, it's like, okay, you know, some of these fish are pretty rare or endangered or, you know, threatened because of this wild collection. And we actually don't really breed a lot of them, especially for saltwater. So that was kind of an idea as I learned a little more, like, oh, that, you know, breeding ornamental fish sounds kind of cool. Originally, it was actually diving for the deep water species that I was like, ooh, maybe that's what I'll do. Like, I'm talking, you know, 300-400 feet, and like these deep ledge species that they sell for like, oh, I don't know, $5,000 to $10,000 a fish that's only like maybe a few inches long, but some of the most beautiful species you'll ever see, and some of the most rich and undiscovered species. That, as I learned more, you know, never ended up really getting dive certified until later in college. It was like, okay, maybe that's not the move. But aquaculture, the first class I took, immediately hit even more home of like, oh, this is like not just something I would enjoy, but super important, really, in a very rapidly growing industry around the world, and something that we actually really don't have a lot of scientific understanding of, at least compared to other forms of agriculture. Actually, interestingly, the class I took, the aquaculture professor, he's actually Frank Chapman, the guy who first captive reared sturgeon, which is a pretty major species and one that's threatened because of, you know, people wanting caviar, but now most of it is coming from farms. He taught this class, but brought in a chicken scientist and professor, because basically this agricultural research and the way we've grown and developed chickens over decades and decades, 100 years plus of actual like formal scientific research, it's made an animal that's, you know, I mean, for lack of better words, perfect for farming and growing. And that's, you know, another topic of animal welfare and stuff we can, you know, that's a whole nother area. But it was really eye-opening of like, oh wow, we have like way more species of fish that we could learn about and figure out what's best to grow, and B, like, we haven't even started to figure out, like, tilapia and, you know, salmon are the ones we know the most about, and carp, but like, even then there's a lot of room for improvement through like genetic selection and different stuff. So it was like, okay, there's a lot to do here. I like this. And that's what led me eventually to Harbor Branch.
Can I interject before we
Yes.
get to
Yeah.
Harbor Branch?
Yes.
So, first of all, you were talking about aquaculture a whole lot. Could you give me like a 30,000 foot view what aquaculture means?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, sometimes I forget about that, where, you know, some of our friends that I've worked or been with know what that is. But aquaculture is just the farming of any aquatic life. So fish, shrimp, those, but also things like clams, other mollusks, seaweeds, algae, and what you guys have worked with, and a lot of people don't maybe consider it or call it this, but it really is coral. And I think that's an area that is vastly and quickly becoming very important, and really needs the attention of being aquaculture, because there's a lot of stuff that, you know, people that grow stuff in tanks can really help people trying to grow corals. And weirdly, a lot of the innovation in aquaculture has stemmed from ornamental aquarium keeping, both with saltwater and freshwater. And a lot of the stuff you guys now employ on large scale coral propagation started with aquariums, which is so cool, because aquarists learned a lot of this stuff just through more trial and error and sharing with each other, not as much through science. But then it's now become important, and a lot more scientists have gotten involved, and it's really cool. And a lot of corals in the trade now are, you can, most of them are aquacultured, or like, it's, you know, a lot easier to get those and more reliably, and of all these different crazy strains. So yeah. But yes, sorry. Broad view, aquaculture, culturing of any aquatic animal, and it includes a lot of things. And not, yeah, not necessarily just for food, for really any use.
I think
That's
it's
awesome.
crazy. I come from a family of farmers, and just thinking about aquaculture, it's like a whole nother level. Like you picture farming, and you can basically plop a cow on a plot of grass and it's going to be happy. We're putting it in an ecosystem that we're very familiar with. It's going to be fine. But the ocean is like this whole other level. We, like you were saying, you have to know everything about the water. You're basically recreating a whole ecosystem to grow this organism in. And I just think that's mind-blowing. It's so cool.
Yeah, and I think trying to recreate the whole ecosystem is the key word of, even if you're just keeping fish or shrimp in a tank and needing to keep the water quality and get out the basically the toxins that fish and other water organisms release, that we would release normally as poop or pee, they basically just release into the water, or as their poop decomposes, releases things like ammonia. That's toxic, but in nature and in the ocean and places where there's fish and water normally, that gets treated by bacteria. And so in aquaculture, those are the things normally you would need to remove, otherwise your fish will die. And so you're relying on this bacteria and this essentially almost like a symbiotic relationship between these two. The bacteria will keep the water clean, and then the fish supply the nutrients and stuff for the bacteria. But to even further that is, okay, that's only, you know, kind of two steps we have on the whatever, the food chain, food web. Where I really want to see aquaculture go, and why honestly I ended up at Harbor Branch, is taking this a step further and adding in more of these pieces of the food web and doing what we call multi-trophic aquaculture. And that's something we don't even do on really urban, or not urban, land-based agriculture much yet, is we focus on monocultures, which has gotten us far, and due to other sort of potentially, you know, bad methods of what's the word? Not commercial farming, but industrial farming, like that, we've kind of were able to produce a lot more food, but now it's kind of coming into the picture, like maybe this isn't the best way to produce it. Aquaculture is just starting where now, okay, instead of having, like, let's say we're growing a bunch of cattle and all of their manure, their poop is, you know, waste. Now, farming's getting better with this on land, and aquaculture, this is the next step of, okay, we have what we call waste products, but that's not what it is. In nature, there's no waste. Those, you know, feces, that nutrients, is going to get used by something on a lower level. So like the bacteria, but then you add in the ocean, you've got at the very bottom things like detritivores, sea cucumbers, sea urchins, things that might feed on some of that matter, shrimp even, and even some fish. But then you also have then algaes, seaweeds, and like more microalgaes that we're finding a lot of amazing uses for, very healthy. They remove a lot of the nutrients from the water that these other organisms produce. So if you can kind of find a way to combine these and, you know, have one species that you feed, which in aquaculture, your biggest expense is feed. And then this is a criticism of a lot of aquaculture, is you have to feed fish to grow them. But that's the same with any agriculture. And fish grow a lot more efficiently than any other agriculture because they're in water. They don't have to fight gravity. They're also cold-blooded, so they're more or less the temperature of their surroundings, so they don't have to waste energy on that. They can grow at a feed conversion ratio, is what we talk about a lot in agriculture and aquaculture, and that's basically how much food you put into an animal and how much you get out in terms of meat, basically. For fish, it can be like 1-to-1, maybe even better. Whereas something like chickens, the next most efficient or sustainable protein, I think they're anywhere from like 2 to 3 pounds of input to pounds of production. Cows, oh, they're bad. They're like, you know, double digits for sure. And so that's why, in general, improving and growing our aquaculture industry can produce food a lot more efficiently and potentially sustainably than a lot of the ways we're doing it on land. And in general, we're seeing a trend of more seafood consumption. People are realizing it's healthy, a lot of it, actually. And then also, you know, we're facing a lot of problems with wild fisheries really depleting and collapsing in places. And, you know, we've basically produce the same amount of wild caught fish since, I want to say, 1990 about. It's hovered around 100 million metric tons, give or take, you know, 10, 20 million, which is a lot. But slowly and steadily, the only way we've been able to produce seafood or more seafood is through aquaculture. And that has now reached the point in the past, you know, few years of actually equaling or surpassing the total production of wild fisheries. So that is just kind of the trend that's going to have to happen as more people are born onto this planet and more people in general are finding, okay, we want, like, especially the U.S. being one of the biggest, where not a lot of people eat seafood before, but it's growing in popularity for sure. And aquaculture is not only a big reason for that, but also a big thing we need to continue to develop and invest in, because like other agriculture, if we just go about it the same way, it can end, in my opinion, just as bad, if not worse, of industrial and environmental pollution. And that's not going to help us, because really it could be in a way symbiotic with wild fisheries, where we produce a lot of things our own through farming, but a lot of this farming takes place in the ocean that certain types of, like, what they would call, what we've been calling at work, especially like restorative species, are some of these ones that are honestly what we also consider keystone species. So like things like coral, clams, mussels, area, things that essentially we're farming like plants out in the water and we don't have to add anything, but they're also essentially cleaning and helping the water and then providing habitat. So then you get more fish, which then we can catch more fish. So it's I think, not a us versus them. It's a, and hopefully more, you know, commercial fishermen are realizing this, like it can kind of be, you know, working together. It's not, we're trying to just, you know, completely get rid of commercial fishing. But I think truly, you know, the large scale commercial fishing we've gotten into is not sustainable. We know that it needs to be done more on a smaller local level. And then additional production can come from aquaculture.
This is so cool.
As you can tell, I enjoy talking about it a lot. and have a lot.
No, it's awesome.
Would you tell me a little bit about what, like, are there any environmental concerns you see associated with aquaculture? I know that there's been like some pushback against certain kinds of aquaculture, things like shrimp aquaculture happening in places where mangroves used to be, or open ocean aquaculture. Do you have any thoughts on any of that kind of stuff that you could share?
Yeah, definitely. And this is to that extent of wanting to educate people on the ocean and marine science. Aquaculture became really interesting because I even was, kind of under a different impression when I first started learning of and there's a lot a few kind of common things I'll talk about that a lot of people have heard, and there's reason for that. And the first one being that I kind of mentioned, like, you're feeding fish to grow, or like you got to feed the fish to grow them. And traditionally, or for a long time, that's relied on wild caught fish meal and fish oil, because fish do need these oils and proteins just like we actually do, but even more potentially. And that's a great source that, realistically isn't eaten by people that much. Thing is that's changing with the science. We're recognizing that we can't rely on just that to feed all these other fish. That's not going to work. If you can't just take a one and just grow it into a four, so we're finding alternate feed sources, which some of them are plant-based. A lot of things like soy and other plant meals can be added and potentially useful. But then you kind of still have to figure out what those might be lacking, because most fish are not vegetarians. They are usually carnivores, especially the ones we eat. So then we're looking into even other things like certain, what's the chicken, and this is a bad name in my opinion, byproduct meal. Sounds gross. It's like, ew, byproduct, gross. What is that? But really what it is the stuff left over from chicken processing that, yeah, is not really edible for us, but they basically grind it up, dry it, process it, and then it's a dry, powdery meal that has protein, calcium, and other important things in it that can then be added to a fish pellet with other ingredients. So it's just using something that would otherwise be quote unquote waste. That's a big area the industry is changing, and a lot. And also, you have a lot of species that don't require feed inputs, or like carp or tilapia might feed on algae or things that could be present. Or then you've got seaweeds or clams and such that, yeah, for the most part, if you're growing them out in the ocean, are do not need to be fed. So there's that. That's one big sort of criticism, and I think it's a fair one. But something that has now changed a lot that, I think you really should be aware that that's not as big of a problem. The other environmental ones are going to be more environmental pollution related. And this is where it can vary a lot, really. And as with any industry, we know is like, if it's done right, or, with the intention of preserving the environment, it can be done that way. Whereas there's ways that, you can do things and just solely care about producing the most, that the environment itself is less of a factor. However, with aquaculture and polluting the environment, I don't think that's sustainable, because you kind of, depending on the type of aquaculture you do, rely on that environment still with the water. So like, it's in your interest, in my opinion, to preserve it. Now, ways that can be done, or areas that that's been a problem, like with shrimp farming, is one. Destruction of mangrove habitat, so we need to be like more aware of where we develop these farms. And as well, that's where like technologies like recirculating versus a pond could be better, because you can produce a lot more shrimp in a smaller area than big open ponds. And then the other area that can be bad is the nutrient pollution. So if you're growing a lot more fish or shrimp, something like that, that produces waste in an area than would naturally be there, you're going to run into nutrient pollution. Now, recirculating aquaculture is an example where you contain most of that and treat it, or, do something with it so it's not just being flushed into the environment potentially. Something very, I'd say, heavily criticized aquaculture-wise, the net pen or cage farming. basically has that nutrients going directly into the environment. Now, if you're having huge net pens in an area where there's not a lot of water exchange or basically harboring a lot more biomass than what would normally be there, that can cause a lot of problems. But I think we really need to look at that type of aquaculture, and even offshore where, you know, they say those nutrient pollution problems are less, like as a potential if you do it in the correct way, because I think, yeah, you know, you can still have a smaller scale net pen thing maybe on like coasts in Canada or Norway where, you know, it's not as large, giant scale all in one bay, but you got to be kind of smart where you zone things. And that's like actually the way some of what I do now, like the industry and in Florida is, you know, wants to develop things is like with our clam leases, we put in, you know, research and kind of decide where's good areas that aren't really healthy seagrass or already clam beds, because why would we want them potentially disturbing those when we can give them a nice sandy area that you can put your oysters in your clam bags and basically be adding to the environment on top of what's already there and healthy. So there's, you know, these criticisms that I think are very valid. But that's where we have to look at how we're approaching things and recognize there's ways to, you know, get around or change these negatives and potentially even become positives. Like the nutrients, again, it's not a waste product. We can find uses for it. It can be plant for like the you know, excuse my French, fishy shit water is great for plants. Oh my God, they love it. So like that, or, you know, some of these other scrap products from other fisheries, like the leftover fish scraps can be turned into fish meal. Or we're looking into one really popular feed additive is black soldier fly larvae, which is a fly, and the larvae gets, you know, up to like this big. It's basically a maggot, and they eat pretty much anything, trash, poop, meat, plant, whatever, and grow real fast, turn it into dense protein, good quality stuff that we can then grind up and feed to fish. Or, you know, some fish just, I was feeding them to my, you know, pet fish we had in our tanks. And you can feed them like leftover food scraps from restaurants. So I think it's more about how we approach things, and aquaculture, you know, is changing rapidly and in a place where with these things in mind, we can develop it to become what I think is a very sustainable industry compared to, you know, how we've developed other agriculture practices. So that's where I hope it goes and where I want to see it go, and why I kind of do what I do. Because you know, those questions are all very good, and a lot of people have those. And that's why I like talking about it.
Well, speaking of what you do, tell us what you do now. What is your current position?
So currently I work for the government, in the state of Florida, in the Division of Aquaculture. And I will say, like, I am not acting on my position there. I'm doing this on my free time, because as a state representative, I have to represent the states and its interest and the industry as a whole, which, you know, honestly, pretty much all goes along with what I've already talked about and feel. But, you know, I still, as an individual, have to clarify that.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I started that job, I think now 4 months ago, so it hasn't been too long. And we were talking briefly before, it's my first introduction to like really what's mostly an office job in a way, in a normal 8-to-5 and, you know, wearing pants and all this, which there's a lot of people interested or working in marine science know is not always the norm potentially, yeah. But you know, sometimes it is, especially as you get honestly higher up in your career. But yeah, I work with the education, development, and policy related projects and programs. So I'm basically helping educate both, you know, my specialty is high school and school related programs, and helping build systems there that they can grow fish and plants together, called aquaponics. And teach agriculture and other science principles with, then yeah, help with other, you know, kind of workforce development, because that's where we're at, where aquaculture is really just bursting and trying to grow. But honestly, we are lacking so much skilled labor because there really hasn't been much training or education, or really even, you know, it's kind of gone up and down. Aquaculture's in the early 2000s was really growing in the U.S. for a bit, and interest on certain scales, but then kind of died down. And I think it's growing again with a lot more interest in domestic food production, that we need to invest in that, which is cool to also see that, yeah, like the federal and state governments really are, I think, taking note of this and trying to grow that. And that's where we've got a lot of stuff going on, a lot of projects, and work with some of the colleges around the state, as well as a lot of public schools. So it's nice to see that. I think there's a lot of positive growth there potentially.
Where?
Yeah, I think it's really awesome what you're doing with education, because when I was in high school, my biology teacher was actually a marine biologist, and he introduced us to aquaculture. We actually had big tanks in our classroom, like big circular ones, and had local fish species in it that we were growing right next to our desks, and got to go visit a fish hatchery. But that was my first introduction to aquaculture and learning, like, how, at least in New York State, upstate New York, how we utilized it to repopulate our local streams, rivers, lakes. So that was really important to me, learning about marine biology and aquaculture at a super young age. So I think it's awesome what you're doing.
Oh, I think that's a perfect example of why I also think something like this is important, is exposing kids to that in real life and hands-on is such a great way to learn. And especially maybe being more landlocked away from an ocean to learn, you know, still these principles, it's hugely helpful in ecosystems, chemistry, biology, all of that. That's where, yeah, like, we're really, I think people are starting, and it is work, like, if you're a teacher trying to do this. But if you can get creative with it and understand, you know, how to get these kids into it, it's something they can get into helping with and learning. And yeah, I think my direction I'm interested in, you know, growing at my job now is, like, hopefully getting some sort of programs, events that will take kids to some actual farms or places like Harbor Branch, because, like, dang, I just think about, if I had those opportunities, that would have made such a difference in school at a young age. Like, so just exposing kids a little bit to it even is awesome. And that's where,
I see
kind of my path. And you know, I had a job this summer too that I'm sure you guys want to hear about, because that's more dive related.
That was actually gonna be my next question. I was gonna ask you how you got into education, because you went from, like, research aquaculture to now this education job, and I know your summer job had a little to do with that. So
yes.
Yeah, if you want to jump into that, I'll be happy to.
Yeah, I'll start a little bit, because the education thing, yeah, like, you know, I went through grad school because I was interested in research and seeing if that was a further path I wanted to take, and I'm still, you know, potentially interested in that further down the line. But as I was, done with that for a bit and seeing, like, what sort of maybe more commercial or, you know, not research related aquaculture things can I do? And then in another weird kind of twist, I was applying to some jobs and found this one online. It's a company called Broadreach Adventures, I believe, or Broadreach Summer Adventures. And basically a summer adventure program for, they even do middle school. But the one I got hired for was a high school program for sailing and diving, but also for a marine science, actually credit hours, like at a college level for these kind of high school going into college age, kids. And so I was the marine science instructor, and I was excited and ecstatic to kind of get offered or get this job at first, because I really just to all those out there starting their journey, like just submit to stuff that sounds interesting. Like you never really know. And this was one, didn't have any connections at, really wasn't expecting to hear back. And they got back pretty quick and it was like, oh, well, I haven't heard back from anything else. This is like a, I basically was living on a sailboat down in some islands in the Caribbean, diving and teaching. And it was like, this is perfect. I want to try the teaching. And I ended up really loving it. So that's where then this next job, as I was looking, I'm like, okay, this combines both aquaculture and teaching, you know, maybe even though it's a government and office job that I'm not used to, like it's definitely up my alley. And it's been a good experience so far.
Okay, so you mentioned diving, and this is a scuba diving podcast. So I have to ask, what is your dive education? Walk us through your background, but then also what you did this summer.
That whole kind of background of how I grew up in Florida and being on the reef snorkeling and maybe even said diving. I didn't get certified actually till I think my senior year of college. I don't know. It was something I never did, mainly snorkeling and occasionally used like a Brownie third lung growing up. And then through college in Gainesville, I was like, I didn't actually need it there and didn't want to spend the money or time until eventually my parents were like, hey, you know, well, we should gift you. And I'm like, yeah, finally. So that was my intro. I did get certified down in Fort Lauderdale and did some dives down in the Keys. And I was super comfortable in the water. So like wasn't really much of a problem. Just learning some of the more technical stuff and putting your gear together was what was new. And then really kind of didn't dive for like a year maybe or two after getting certified. And then actually with you two, I think, or Haley maybe went to Blue Heron, and that was I think the first dive I'd done in a while, and was great to get back in it. I love Blue Heron. It kind of reminds me of growing up on one of the inlets I did, and this sort of urban seawall, what I consider Florida muck diving. Super cool. I've always known about that stuff growing up, being a kid snorkeling around this Hillsborough Inlet. Like, oh my God, you'd see so many cool little weird fish. And like, you know, I love seeing all the divers get into it now and realizing like, oh, this, you know, all the Florida inlets are like that. Fort Pierce is probably one of the better ones too. It's just dirty water all the time. and yeah, you got to know how the tides work. But yeah, it's not a ton of experience. And so like I got hired again as a marine science instructor. There was a dive instructor, and the kids would be getting both their open water and advanced on this trip, which was actually another bonus. I'm like, oh, can I do some stuff like, you know, on the side? And yeah, so I was able to get my advanced while I was there, which was really also
That's awesome.
entertaining with the kids, where, you know, they're high school and young kids, like they need help and are looking at others. And you know, even though I'm not the dive instructor and made that very clear, they're still like, Ethan, what do I do? And I'm, you know, what's this? And like, you know, I'm like, if you see something and want to know what it is, yeah, I'm your guy. But you know, please don't rely your life on me when I don't have. And then at the end, they're all getting their books signed, and our dive instructor's like, congrats, everyone. You know, you're officially like advanced open water. And then I followed up with, yeah, congrats, everyone. You're officially more certified than I am. And they're like, what? And I'm like, but I'm still a better diver than you, because I did grow up in the water. Like being comfortable underwater is important. And that's, I think, when it comes to getting dive certified and being a good diver is really why you need to do all those dives, is to get comfortable for someone who maybe didn't, you know, grow up kind of doing that. I'd like to get some more certifications and still more experience, because although I'm comfortable underwater and won't panic, I'm still a little clumsy and, you know, want to learn some of the more technical stuff. I think it's pretty cool. I'm glad I got into it.
So, before we get into the fun stuff, is there any kind of challenges that you faced early in your career or anything that you like wish you knew as a younger person in this career track that maybe someone who's interested in getting into it might be able to take and either, face that challenge or be kind of more informed about it?
Yeah, I think so. In undergrad and at UF with their marine science program, it was newer, maybe only a few years old. So there's always going to be kind of learning, growing pains with how that works and how they can help their students. So I think A, keeping that kind of in mind with wherever you might go for school, and yes, established programs can be good because of that. And that organization and that base and those connections, but also new programs can be good because there's a lot easier to kind of get your foot into to places and make things your own. Now, with that being said, and I don't know if this was necessarily as much of a struggle, but maybe something that isn't talked about as much by like maybe guidance counselors or your counselors or people, even professors and such, but like some of them will ring it true and like just get out there, go to the classes, go to meetings of clubs that are related to the field and start meeting people. And then volunteer is kind of the initial way, because I yeah even though I had a background growing up on the ocean and great grades and all that, like really what got me to where I am now started literally, I think, with a friend I made in college who was older and in the marine science program and then starting grad school. And like he really helped kind of guide me at least with some of the ways to go, but more I ended up just helping him with some of his thesis work, and which was literally just sifting through sand and picking out microscopic clams and IDing them. But that gave me a little bit of experience, and then I met people at the fisheries lab and then got an internship there one summer because of that, because I had some proof and some skills. And then when it came to Harbor Branch, like had a legitimate ex internship, and that's where you kind of keep building on that and just apply to things too. Again, like the Broadreach job, which definitely for people kind of looking for an adventure, whether it's diving as a dive instructor, a sail instructor, or a marine science instructor, highly recommend looking into that company. They have a lot of programs around the world too, not just the Caribbean, but that's their big ones. And yeah, it's you kind of got to put yourself out there, because the things that end up happening and you can take, like that's kind of where it builds, and you can, whether it's something long term or not, in the beginning you're figuring out. Like I thought for a long time I wanted to do fisheries research because I wanted to protect the fish and get more better fishing. Realized I don't really like this. Some of the lab work I was doing was terrible, and I didn't like lab work in general. And then also just the way that science goes, and then communicating it to people is hard. And then I saw, okay, I think aquaculture I could do equally as much, if not more, in terms of helping protect or conserve our wildlife, but also now have somewhere where people are interested a little bit more, I think, in learning about it and being open to it. But regardless, still, that's where like, okay, that internship gave me a good idea, and like just trying some of these things, and even if you can volunteer, do it. To just see, like, okay, like, yeah, maybe I do like working on a microscope. Like, some people love that. I prefer, yeah,
Not
doing
me.
hand-on, yeah, stuff. Like, I definitely recognize that. I'm much more at home, yeah, doing that sort of thing. Now, you kind of have to be able to do both in this field, I think. Yeah,
Sometimes,
like,
yeah, for sure.
that's definitely, my one regret actually in terms of school and like what could have helped my career, take some damn coding classes. Oh my God. I hate coding, believe me. And I don't think I'll ever be good at it because I don't want to be at this point, which is not a good mindset to have. But I can also tell you, with my thesis being related a lot to data collection and prediction of environmental conditions, oh my God, being able to do that is so useful on so many levels, not just statistics, but also like simple coding to like basically build your own little systems that otherwise, if you're trying to, like for Haley, I know some of her Coral stuff, like you can build little controllers and recorders that otherwise might cost thousands and tens of thousands of dollars because scientific equipment is BS overpriced. So yeah, it's very useful. I recommend getting into that regardless if you like it or not, because it is useful. And I wish I had an earlier start. But, and here's what I'll add to that though. And this is why the experience in a lot of fronts is also good. Being well-rounded is what's important, especially with marine science, is like understanding that, okay, yeah, you're good at coding and statistics, but like you can't apply this to this system because you don't understand what a fish is versus a lobster. Like, you know, now we need to combine that of like, okay, I've got a really good understanding of how the biological and physical world works. How can I use this newer technology to learn about that? I think that's where people really need to focus on with the coding and like getting either if you have the more science real world application of these systems and then learning coding, or if you learn coding, try and learn that and you'd be so well off. Oh my God. You can do anything.
Yeah. We always say you gotta be a generalist in this field.
You kinda do, honestly. I think Swiss, there's something Swiss to be Army said. Knife. Yeah. Yes.
Cool. Well, thank you for that advice. And yeah, Sid, do you want to ask the next one or do you want me to?
I got it. Okay.
Silly question time.
Silly question time. What is your best dive, snorkel, water-related story, working or not? You can tell that one that you were thinking of earlier.
Yeah. So one dive story that came to mind that, at least in terms of dive training, was the one thing I was qualified for, and that was the fish ID dive. So, you know, we'd have our instructor, but then she'd take me and be like, you know, you point stuff out for him and do that. I'm like, hell yeah. Because I know she was like astounded, because she actually did also get her undergrad in marine science from University of South Carolina. Actually, yeah, shout out to Peter and Annabelle. I'm going to send this to them because they're the best. They're my dive instructor and captain. So yeah, we're playing out some fish and like they have to, you know, draw one and then count some and try an ID. And then she's like, okay, like, you know, we're underwater and I'm still not great at communicating anyways, but like I'm next to her and we've got our like slate with like, you know, one of the things is like, okay, you have to be able to ID if it's like a fish, an invert, a plant. And like, it, honestly, the categories didn't even, like two of them were the same basically. It was like plant and seaweed or something. I don't know. And I'm like, what can I give them that's kind of hard that I think that they should know, but I think will trick them. And I'm like, what's something that like looks like a plant, but is an animal, but not coral. Cause we've talked enough about that. I knew. And these, the two girls on this dive, like they were already certified coming on. So they were ahead of at least them. And like, one of them, super marine sciencey girl to begin with, and loved all that. So she knew stuff a good bit already. So I find a sea cucumber, which I was stoked on because I'm like, wait, if I can find one of these, this would be great. And I found this big old one on the reef, and then I'm like, oh, this is perfect. And I'm like, you know, point at them. And they're like, and then like I get, and I'm like, you know, and I like wrote it on the Annabelle's slate, and like, you know, showed it to her before. She's like, oh, that was funny. And they're like, oh, I don't know. And they plant it, like, I want to say, like, plant and, like, basically everything except invert. And it was just funny at the end.
Like, it's a rock.
I was like, technically, you're not almost wrong with a plant. It's named after one. But, yeah, I thought that was a funny dive-related one. I'm trying to think what else.
Sea cucumbers just always look like logs or like giant ocean turds.
That's like, and it's funny because I think on that trip, actually, one of the other girls, you know, in the beginning where it's getting to know them and trying to get them out of their shells. And she was a quiet girl, but very into the marine science and like just really sharp with and into the kind of cryptic or the weird things. And we were like, what do you want to see the most? She's like, sea cucumbers. And we're like, ooh, that's one we have not heard. And honestly, like, A, I think we can find them, which is great. And B, like, I like that. And then she ended up finding so many nudibranchs that trip, which really, like, out in the reefs and like a lot of the areas we're diving, they're not that common. The entire summer, the rest of it, I think I saw one or two myself, that like I never found on my own. She found one of them and my captain on another trip, and like he's big into that stuff, and a dive instructor on his own right, aside from just a captain, but very much loves nudibranchs. And like, yeah, found maybe two the whole summer, and like she found five in a 17-day trip. I was like, and like at first I was a little skeptical, but she showed two of them to me and I'm like, no, I think she's finding them. Like, she's just got the eye. Wow. I loved it.
That's awesome. Yeah, once you get the eye for it, I think they mm-hmm. come so much more easily.
Agreed. And as someone who really growing up, I've always been into the cryptic weird fish. So like that's been my specialty. Mm-hmm. Like I was impressed. Like I'm not very good with maybe the nudibranchs yet, but when it comes to like scorpion fish or weird stuff like that or weird inverts, usually mm-hmm. I'm finding that stuff, whereas everyone else is like, ooh, you know, shark, or ooh, big angel fish or parrot fish. I'm like, staring at a rock. There's got to be something here, you know?
Yeah, right.
I know Lawrence is into that.
Yes, yeah, Lawrence could stare at a rock for 4 hours and not move, which it's okay. I dig
yeah,
it.
I think
I like it too.
So. That's the thing. I think part of that is as you get, and I also think this adds to your enjoyment of diving, is learning the ecosystem and where things are and where to find them and what they do. And then the smaller things, because that's where it's like the muck diving and these seawalls, like there's actually a lot to see. You just got to kind of slow down a little and look closely. And just such totally unique, special animals.
I know. I love teaching fish ID for that reason. It's like I'll get these people who are like, I don't know, a fish is a fish is a fish. And then they walk out of my class and they're like, so what kind of a juvenile angelfish was that? You know, like
love it.
It's so fun to watch their brain just kind of switch. And once they start realizing that each of the fish looks different, like truthfully, a lot of my friends kind of, or like a lot of my students anyway, kind of come into it with like a like fish are the same, like fish are all just you know, oh, that one was yellow, you know, like that's all I got. But then once you start like pointing things out to them, like, oh, do you notice their body shape is different, they're swimming with different fins, their mouth shape is different, their mouth is in a different place on their body, like, you know, they have vertical stripes versus horizontal stripes. Some of them change patterns, you know, and when you start pointing these things out, people get excited. And I always, you know, every time I have someone who's like, you know, a fish is a fish, I start off feeling kind of like, man, maybe I don't have anything to offer this person. Like, maybe they're not going to want to listen to me rant about fish for a day and a half or whatever. But by the end of it, every time, you know, even people who don't walk away like as obsessed as I am, which is hard to
be,
I love fish, but I feel like they all walk away with something, you know, like some new appreciation, which is super cool. I love it.
I think one of my favorite things was truly, and I told the kids, I'm like, you guys challenged me. I dare you to find something I can't figure out. And like, it truly was like, even I was a little like, dang, I'm good, because they would come up and be like, ooh, I saw this fish. It was yellow, had like a little bit of blue here. And I'm like, is it this? Pull out the book, look it up. And they're like, oh my God. Yeah. And everyone's like, what? Even, like my Annabelle was so impressed. And like, I was very happy, honestly, when to other, all the other divers, she's like, Ethan knows all the fish. Like, he's so, and I'm like, yes. It's literally
Ethan
been my
is the
life.
Fish god.
I love it.
Well, after all of this time, what is it that keeps you coming back to the water, Ethan?
It's in my blood, honestly. I like, there was a quote I used this summer. Damn, I really wish I could remember it more fully. I want to say it was a John F. Kennedy quote too, which was interesting. But it was basically, if I can remember correctly, and this is where I might even be wrong on who said it, but the premise is still the same. We are all of blood, and all of our blood has salt water, and the same salt water that runs through the oceans, essentially. And kind of recognizing or connecting that is like, I think the ocean and nature in general, but the ocean ultimately has that effect of bringing people together, but also then bringing people together with nature, and because it's the ultimate humbling force, but then also a truly incredible life-giving force when you respect it. So like I said, I grew up with it, so it's in my blood in that sense. I can't get away from it, and it continues to surprise me. I continue to learn and continue to be amazed. So it's, yeah, it's got me entranced for sure.
You could say it, awesome. It's got you hooked.
Oh, dang it. Fish, you got me puns. There. And I am very much, I think that's almost a requirement in our field. You have to love bad puns. Damn, I wish I would have thought of that one.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast today, Ethan.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I'm really happy to get to do this because I've enjoyed watching your guys' show grow. And also, yeah, I want to, you know, expose people more to aquaculture, which, yeah, maybe a lot of people here are for the diving, but I will say, you know, aquaculture, again, a lot of different fields, a lot of different potential careers, but with these offshore and more ocean type farming with coral, clams, kelp, or fish, they need divers. So, you know, it's aquaculture still very much could be connected to diving, and regardless is connected to the ocean. So, recommend anyone looking into it, reaching out. If you're in Florida and need resources, a lot of the schools, University of Florida, Harbor Branch, FAU, and then our department with the government, the Division of Aquaculture, offer resources to help people. So reach out to them if you're ever interested.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode. Don't forget to head on over to our website where you can find information on submitting your great stories for our Fish Tales episodes. Those will come out about once a month, and you can find the form to submit your stories online.
Our website is under titleteesapparel.com. There's a little header at the top that says To Dive For Podcast. And if you hit that link, we also have merch for sale. And you can also find us on Instagram at To Dive For Podcast and on Facebook as well.
Alrighty. You know, if you listen to the end of the episode every week, you get a fish fact. And this week's fish fact is about By the Wind sailors, Valella Valella. And this is because we've had a bunch of them washing up here on our coastline in South Florida. So our fact about them this week is that their biggest threats include changing ocean temperatures, ocean acidification, and increased human activity in the ocean along coastlines. Specifically, microplastics pose a really big threat, as this is one of the places they can enter into the food web and begin to bioaccumulate. Keep an eye out for these cool little critters as you do your next beach comb or beach walk here in South Florida throughout the spring. See you next week.